Good morning, everybody, again. Last week, so what we've talked about so far is, and I'll kind of do a little quickie review here, is the teachings of emptiness and no-self. We're moving right through, right through these key teachings. Emptiness, no-self, and Buddha nature. So as you recall, the teachings of emptiness mean empty of separateness, empty of isolation, empty of permanence. So remember that the term empty is not depressing. It's not isolating. It doesn't mean some kind of dry void, just the opposite. It means empty of inherent existence, empty of separateness, empty of isolation. And that's the same as the term dependent co-arising, right? It means everything comes in to being together. You will never find something that isn't dependent upon everything else for its existence. It's very easy to see this in our lives. We're dependent on the air that we breathe. We're dependent upon the food that we eat and the people that made that food, you know, the farmers that work in the fields, and on and on and on and on and on. There's nothing you will ever find that exists separately or permanently. Nothing, which includes the self, right? And that's the teachings of no self. No self does not mean there's not a self. That means that there's not a separate, isolated self, permanent self. Okay, so this is, as we've said, sometimes it's going to be a little challenging, right? A little scary, like, what do you mean? You know, there's not something separate. What it means is you don't exist in the way you think you do. But it again, this is very important. You do exist. Look around. You
know? Thanks.
Thanks, yeah. So this is important because sometimes people think these teachings are about erasing something. And that's true. It is erasing something. It's erasing ignorance. It's erasing or melting or somehow poking holes in the deluded notions that we have that cause us to suffer. Okay, so that's the point. And then we started talking about Buddha nature, right? And Buddha nature can sometimes sound to people like a soul or an essence or some special woo-woo thing that we can locate someplace in our body or soul. But that, again, is not an accurate understanding. Buddha nature is not different from the vivid aliveness that's arising in this moment, right? It's not a permanent thing because it's a positive language. The teachings of emptiness are about not this, not this, not this, right? They're like knocking down our deluded notions about things. And the teachings of Buddha nature, the Buddha nature treatise says, Buddha nature exists. Okay? It actually existence. So it's kind of like these two kind of go together. These two types of language, which in the Christian tradition is called apophatic and cataphatic, for those of you that care about such things. The language of negation and the language of positive. As human beings, we need to be able to work with these things in this way. If we tend to go towards nihilism or dryness or despair if we just talk not no 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 no, which is not the point of the teachings. And we tend to build an essence up if we say yes, 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 yes. So we're always like yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Yeah, like that. So if we the key thing about what Dogen's said. Dogen is the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, right? There was a saying, all beings have Buddha nature. Have Buddha nature, right? That's a kind of ownership, right? It sounds like there's something there that we have. When we have something, we have a dog, we have a house, we have a relationship, we have an idea. There's a we, and there's this thing that we have, right? That has a certain feel to it. Has a certain kind of feel to it, right? If we say we are something, that has a different feel. So Dogen shifted the... He was very tricky. He liked to play with language. And so he would take these characters and just make them into something else. Yeah. So he changed this from all beings have Buddha nature to all beings are Buddha nature. So if you just allow yourself to feel the difference inwardly in that statement, you know, if you are something, the separation between you and that thing dissolves, doesn't it? It dissolves, and it's not, there isn't that sense of, there's a me here, and then I have this dog, or this house, or this idea, or this experience, or this whatever. There's a kind of dissolution that happens. I am that thing. That's what I am. So, Dogen Zenji says, note the following. Existence completely embraced now by Buddha nature is not that being which is in opposition to non-being. Okay? All existence is the words of the Buddha, their tongues, the eyeballs of the Buddhas and ancestors, the monastics' nostrils. It goes without saying that the word all existence cannot be labeled by such words as subject or object, noumen or phenomenon. In the entire universe, there is not even a single object alien to Buddha nature, nor is there a second existence other than this universe. So what he's trying to tell us here is we habitually, as human beings, divide, we experience the world in terms of subject and object. And there's nothing wrong with that. We have to know to pick up that there's me, and there's a fork, and I put it in this mouth, right, with food on it. So that's a world that we live in, and it has it's a dimension of our experience. What he's pointing to here is there is nothing outside of Buddha nature. There is nothing outside of this vivid, alive reality. There is no second existence, which is the same thing in some ways as saying there is no God. There's no creator God. There's just this. But this is not just, this is a sacred reality. This is alive. This is real. This, moment after moment. So, Buddha nature is another way of talking about interdependence. Yeah? It's another way of talking about impermanence, another way of talking about aliveness. So, I'd like you to reflect for a minute on what happens in your mind and heart and body if you regard your life and everything in it as Buddha nature. What do you think? Do you think it would shift things a little bit?
It's very calm.
Calm. Calm. Anybody else?
Judgment would fall away.
Huh?
Judgment would fall away.
Judgment falls away. Okay.
Control.
Huh?
Control.
Control. Okay.
Sweetness.
Sweetness.
Everything is vibrating.
Everything is vibrating. Yeah.
Luminous.
Luminous.
Precious.
Precious. Okay. We get a sense now. You know, this practice is about transforming our lives. These teachings are about transforming their lives. They're not about building intellectual castles in the air. So we have to make these things personal. We have to like say, what happens to me when I think in this way, when I have this kind of attitude? How does it play out at the grocery store? What actually happens? So it sounds, you know, we can read Dogen and it can sound so like mind-boggling. He's terribly mind-boggling. And the other thing about Dogen is, if you think you understand it, then he'll tell you the opposite thing in the next paragraph. So you're like, wait, will you just stop? And like, just stay there for a minute. But he never does. Because ideas that we have can be very useful, but we need to not cling to them. Okay?
Not always so.
Not always so. That's right. So, when we think in this way, or when we cultivate this attitude, it doesn't mean that everything becomes special. It's interesting about special. I was reading something about how, for children, the most ordinary thing is special, right? Because it's brand new. It's not special. And when we... I went to the David Hockney exhibit up in San Francisco, and it was... I could have stayed in there all day, except for that it got so crowded I couldn't bear it anymore. But he paints or draws or photographs, does all these incredible things about this one lane in England, you know, through the different seasons. It's just this road. Granted, it's pretty, but it's just this road. But there's something about the way he does it and the way he organizes things. It's just like the most fresh experience that we can have of this ordinary road. So that's what I mean about things not being special. You're not looking for some kind of special experience. You're trying to be awake to what's actually here. And the ways that we do that are our practice. Yeah. So when we live like this, it's not just for us, but we give to other beings their true nature. We allow them to be who and what they are. We don't steal from them their essence. Suzuki Roshi said, "The world is its own magic." Somebody I know put that into a piece of art. The world is its own magic. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. And we live and work in concrete reality. So I'm going to tell you a story that's in here. It's a typical Zen story. Okay. Shi Kung and Hui Tsang. Shi Kung Hui Tsang asked Chi Tang Chi Tsang. Okay. Let's just say Joe and Bob. In this story, Joe asks Bob, "Can you grasp emptiness?" Okay, Joe asks Bob, "Can you grasp emptiness?" Bob replied, "Yes, I think I can." Joe said, "How would you grasp emptiness?" Bob grasps the air with his hand. Joe was not satisfied with his response. Bob then asks, "How would you grasp it then?" Joe replied by pulling Bob's nose, whereupon Bob yelped out, "Ouch!" Joe says, "You can grasp emptiness only in this way." Okay? That's the story. What that means is that, you know, grasping emptiness in some special way, thinking we're grasping air, is kind of trite or something, isn't it? It's like, okay. But this, you know, this moment, this, it's concrete. It's concrete. It's alive. It's real. It's not some intellectual understanding. Dogen says about this, that which grasps and that which is grasped are, after all, one and the same. Emptiness grasps emptiness. So one of the ways that we talk about this reality is we use different words. We use emptiness, we use interdependence, we use Buddha nature, and we use the term thusness. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about thusness. If we go back to the Buddha nature treatise, it says, Buddha nature is the thusness revealed by the dual emptiness of persons and things. You got it? Buddha nature is the thusness revealed by the dual emptiness of persons and things. That means if we think everything out there is empty of inherent existence, but you're permanent and exist, that's half the truth. If you think everything out there is permanent and you're fluid, that's half the truth. When we let go of both, there's something that's vivid and alive that comes in this moment, like a pinched nose. You can't settle anywhere. You can't fix on anything permanent. So we could say this is thusness grasping thusness. This is Buddha nature grasping Buddha nature, right? We could use all those terms, and each one of those has a sense to it in our minds, right? We have a feeling about it. If we spend some time with these words, they have a feeling about them. But the point is not in the words. The point is that the words free us from something, some particular, some grasping on, because grasping is suffering, right? This is fundamental. When we grasp onto things, we want to fix it all, we want to control it all. Life doesn't work like that. And so we run head on into the brick wall of reality. Dogen uses the term show, and says, I am thusness and you are thusness also. I am thusness and you are thusness also. This is a kind of relationship, right? I see you. I see who you are. I see who I am. I'm in this with you. One of the reasons I bring this up is because names matter. What we call things matter. We know this, right? If we're called certain things, it matters. Sho is both our name and our nature. Thusness is our name and our nature. Buddha nature is our name and our nature. So when we name ourselves and others thusness, Buddha nature, it makes a difference. Recently I was reading something. Actually, one of my colleagues, who's a Jodo Shin minister, David Matsumoto, wrote something about this and really got me thinking about the various names that Nelson Mandela had and their significance. So let me tell you a little bit about this. I found this very interesting. I'm going to probably slaughter his name in his native language. I have no idea how to pronounce it. I don't only see it written. His given name was Rolihlahla. Rolihlahla, which means troublemaker. That was his first name. Troublemaker. And then Nelson was the name that was given to him by a teacher on his first day of school. Okay. And probably had a roster of names and just said, you know, kind of like Ellis Island, like, okay, this is your name. And then at 16, he went through the initiation rites for his Josa tribe, and was given the name Dali Bunga, which means convener of dialogue. Okay, now think about what it means to be called troublemaker. As a kid, I think there's something kind of sweet about it. And then Nelson is from, you know, kind of organizational name. And then something about becoming an adult, being recognized in some way as having some qualities, convener of dialogue. Boy, that was a prescient name, right? At 16. And then in the 20s, he joined the African National Congress and started really being a troublemaker. He was arrested, as we all know, a number of times. And then he was convicted of sabotage and sentenced to life in prison. He spent 27 years in prison. And for 27 years, he was known as number 466-64. His name was taken from him. He became a number. His identity, his name, the meaning of who he was in the world, it was an attempt to erase by an oppressive government, right? You no longer exist. You no longer have a name. You're now a number. You're just a number. Now, for me, when I heard this, I could feel something about what this means, right? Do you feel that? What would it be like if someone took away your name and just called you by a number for 27 years? But his name was kept alive outside of the prison and in his own heart, right? His name, what he called himself and what others called him, was kept alive. They kept alive his significance, his contribution, his uniqueness, his abilities, right? By keeping his name alive, he was kept alive. And there was a definite subversiveness about this, right? It's subversive to name something differently than the dominant culture wants us to name things. It's really subversive. It's subversive to reclaim language, like the word queer, right? Or the word what? What can we think of? Words.
Nigga.
Huh?
Nigga.
Yeah. All kinds of words that have such power. And we can't forget the power of name. We can't forget the power of particularity. This is important. The teachings of emptiness, the teachings of Buddha nature. Thich Nhat Hanh has a wonderful poem called Call Me By My True Name, in which he talks about how his true name is the name of... he's talking about being on a boat with terrible things happening, right? Rape and piracy and all of these terrible... And he's saying, my true name is the same name as the pirate, as the rapist, as the girl who was raped. That's my true name. My true name is everything. And that's true, and there's particularity. So this question of show, name, and nature is a very deep one, and one that we need to explore in our ordinary lives, to think about what do we call things? How do we relate to things? Do we call them, do we understand that knife and fork and broccoli is also true nature name, Buddha nature? And it's broccoli, and we cook it and eat it. Right? So our names have a way of forming us, and what we call others forms our relationship to them. So it's important to have a name. It's important to listen to others and allow them to give us their name. This kind of deep listening and spaciousness allows life to come forward in its vividness, to use one of Pema's favorite words, and in its actuality, instead of pushing our ideas onto things, which is what we habitually do. We're deluded human beings. It's what we do. But if we can have humility and openness and spaciousness, we allow things to teach us their names. We're not fooled so easily by circumstances and habits. So this is show. This is thusness. The thusness revealed when we don't get caught in our ideas. This is the thusness of a hurt nose. Ouch! Or if you walk away and I call you, say, you're walking away. Liz, you turn around, right? You know your name. Just that moment, that's a kind of waking up. Yes? There's a koan, that's Suigon. Every morning when Suigon wakes up, you say, Suigon? Yes, master. He's talking to himself. Are you awake? Yes, master. Don't be fooled. Every morning. Huh? Yes, master. Who's master? Who's Suigon? What does it mean to be awake? This is what we live with when we try and work with these teachings, you know. And again, it's quite ordinary. Quite ordinary. It has to happen in your everyday life. So, Dogen says again about show. Oh, actually, it's a Kim. Both mind and essence. Again, this is not a fixed essence, permanent essence, are invariably the expression, or more precisely, the self-expression of Buddha nature. In short, there is no expression that is not Buddha nature. This is what Dogen Zenji calls Buddha practicing Buddha's way. Buddha practicing Buddha's way. So you may not think that you're Buddha, but you are Buddha practicing Buddha's way. And so is everything else. We often don't like really believe that. It's really true. Doesn't feel true, but it is. And all of this has a kind of immediacy to it. Now, there's another dimension to this, which is a dimension of time, which I'm not going to talk about. Shinshu's actually writing a book about this right now. And I'm sure you'll have an opportunity to... Some of you have been studying with her for some time on this one fascicle of Dogen's called Uji, being time. And that there's a lot to it, and I'm not going to go over it now, but what I want you to understand is the immediacy of this. That we think usually of, there's these things that go through time, right? Like I was reading about Pooh, Winnie the Pooh. You know, did you ever play Pooh Sticks when you were a kid? You know about Pooh? Who knows about Pooh Sticks? You know about Pooh. You've got kids. You know about. Anybody else know about Pooh Sticks? Okay. It's a really complicated game. It's really hard to do. You need a bridge, a stick, and a river. Okay? And what you do is you stand on one side of the bridge, and you drop sticks into the river, and then you go over to the other side of the bridge, and you watch them come out. That's it. Okay. So normally, we live in a poo-stick universe, right? We think there are sticks and rivers and things that pass over time. There's something here, and it passes over time, and then it gets over here. And that's real. That's true, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to show up in this room together, right, at a certain time. But there's another dimension of time, which is just all things in this moment arising. It's kind of like the vertical dimension of time. All things, all being, everything is included in this moment. Just this one. And then this one, and 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 this one. Dogen says, you should examine the fact that all things and events of this entire universe are temporal particularities. Isn't that a cool? Temporal particularities. GG. All existence and all worlds are contained in a temporal particularity. Just meditate for a moment. Is any existence or any world excluded from this present moment? Think about it. Is there an existence excluded from this moment? Is there some other you someplace else? Some other existence someplace else? No matter where you go in the universe, everything is included in this moment, right? Is that right? So that means this moment includes everything. And this particularity, this moment, this experience, this contains everything. So there you are in the grocery store picking up a package of cookies. That contains everything. There you are walking down the, you know, looking at, I saw pelicans again the other day. I was really surprised. I thought they'd all gone away, but I saw like four pelicans. That contains everything. This moment contains everything. It's a little mind-blowing. But there's nothing outside of this being time. All being and all time, this moment. So, are you with me still? Questions, comments? Because I have another topic I want to go that's related, but I want to, yeah.
So just an extension of that, you talk about it as a vertical dimension, but horizontally.
Yes.
Because of cause and effect, in this moment is every precursor of the next moment,
that's
the next
right.
and the next. So it's
past
really,
and future,
everything's all here.
This is something interesting to grapple with. It's, you know, and I don't like to go too much into science validating Buddhism because, you know, it's just another belief system, although it's the one we most of us sign on for. But it's a very interesting when you think about what's happening in physics and cosmology and the, you know, multiple universes and all this. It's really like, whoa, okay. They're out there rediscovering what Dogen said in 1230.
I've seen the analogy. I've thought of it when we look up and we see stars in the sky. That is, our future is coming towards us.
Uh-huh.
It's already happened. So there really isn't, in that context, a future because it's already happened. It's just because of the speed of light, for example. It is coming to us.
Yeah. And the key is, does this have relevance for your everyday life? And if so, what? That's the key. Because if it doesn't, in my opinion, what difference does it make? But if you look at this from the point of view of your own experience and you say, wow, everything's included in this moment. My being, my awareness, the people in front of me, This is Buddha nature. This is interdependence. This is a certain quality of aliveness. And how I am in this moment matters. It really matters. A moment of kindness matters. A moment of awareness matters. These things matter. And that's why I want to always bring this back to, what difference does this make for us? How does this impact us? Yeah.
Well, couldn't it be that every single thing is relevant and we just aren't quite aware of how that is?
Absolutely.
I mean, the Big Bang and everything that's happened since is relevant.
Yes.
Right?
That's right.
I mean, I may not be able to get my mind around it, but...
Yeah.
At least I can get the idea that...
Right. And sense. Whether we... You know, the extent to which it matters to us is the extent that we can get our mind around it. And what we want is to use these teachings to disrupt our kind of fossilized notions about this and that and who we are and who other people are, so that it becomes, because, you know, Buddha was always characterized as a physician, right? I teach suffering and the end of suffering. That's the relevance. How does this impact us? If we actually experience ourselves as Buddha practicing Buddha's way, it makes a difference.
This question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So in being conscious of everything that's going on, we're also at times keeping ourselves from being present in a way, because if you're, I mean, there's so much going on in the world that makes us this interdependent.
Yeah.
And yet, the more we are involved in the consciousness of what's going on, we're also not always being present, because our mind is also thinking about the other things that make the whole.
We can do that, but the other way to go is to say, and you know, Dogen Zenji says, doing one practice is practicing completely. If you really know that this in front of me contains everything, I don't need to worry about everything. I need to take care of this. This thing, this person, this event, this is where, and this is me. This event, this person, this experience, this contains everything. So I don't have to like have a mind that contains it all. Although when we sit zazen, for example, we're just letting go of everything and allowing life itself to teach us. But when we're going about our daily life, actually, and this happens in zazen too, there's only just this. There's only just this. But if we feel our connection to everything, then it's alive for us in a certain way.
Is that also a difference, though, between awareness and thinking about awareness?
Yes.
If we're thinking about it, we're no longer...
Yeah, we're thinking about it, which is another kind of... It's something we're doing, but it's not the same thing as being fully engaged with this carrot in front of us. The realization... realization is quite ordinary. You know, Dogen didn't like the word Kensho, for example. He didn't like this seeing into, you know, special experiences. What he said is, this moment is practice realization. That's the other thing I wanted to talk about. Shuso ito. Shuso ito. Very important. That when we're alive to this moment, when we're practicing in this moment, that is realization. We don't get someplace else. We're not practicing in order to become enlightened. We're not practicing to become some other kind of being. We're not practicing to get somewhere. One moment of practice is one moment of realization. So here is what he says. In Buddha Dharma, practice and enlightenment are one and the same. Because it is the practice of enlightenment, a beginner's wholehearted practice of the way is exactly the totality of original enlightenment. For this reason, in conveying the essential attitude of practice, it is taught not to wait for enlightenment outside of practice. This must be so because this practice is directly indicated original enlightenment. Since it is already the enlightenment of practice, enlightenment is endless. Since the practice of enlightenment and practice is enlightenment, practice is beginningless. So I want you to get this, that in the spirit of Soto Zen, we're not trying to get someplace else. We're not trying to get a special experience of so-called enlightenment. This moment of practice. Well, what do we mean by practice then? That's the key, right? Does that mean only Zazen? Does that mean being kind to someone? I think so. This moment of practice. This moment in which you, for a moment, melt your attachment to being the center of the universe and allow myriad things to come forth and awaken you. Allow yourself to listen deeply. Allow yourself to be a part of the whole. Not the center of the universe, but a part of the whole. That's a moment of practice. It's like we have this self, right? We walk around with it. It habitually thinks it's the center of the universe. You know? Anybody not have that feeling? Where we organize reality according to what it does for us. Oh, I like the pillow just so I'm asleep. Oh, I want it to be warm in here or cool in here. Or I'm standing in the grocery line and that person in front of me has 12 items in the express checkout line and they're only supposed to have 10 and they're getting in my way. Or I'm in traffic and everybody's getting in my way and I forget that I'm in their way. Right? Or, I don't know, think all the ways that we move through our lives being the center of the universe. Buddha studying Buddha's way is when we melt that for a moment. That is a moment of awakening. When we stop, we listen to the other person. We, with intelligence, give to the other person. Please go ahead of me. You know? That is a kind of generosity of spirit that is joyful. Right? There's joy in that. The Buddha said, in the early teachings, I probably won't get this exactly right, but the person who gives selflessly gives joy. Joy follows them like a shadow. Right? So we have to study this. What does this mean? Buddha nature, show, name and essence, or name and nature. What is realization? You know, these are the teachings of emptiness. You know, these we don't want to crowd our mind with a bunch of notions, but it's useful. It's useful to study and think and generate a curiosity about how we want to live our lives that actually functions. So again, when we talk about selflessness, we're not talking about being a doormat. We're talking about a generosity of giving to ourselves and others, Buddha studying Buddha way. Getting ourself from being emperor baby that's the center of the universe. It's really good for babies to be the center of the universe. They need to be the center of the universe, of their universe, because they need to convince us to take care of them. Right? One of my students where I teach elsewhere just had a baby. And he was talking like 7 days ago. And he was talking about holding his daughter. And he said, she has so much power. You know, she just rearranges who I am. She just like got born and rearranged who I am. You know. So I thought that was a very touching kind of example of interdependence, right? He's allowing himself to be rearranged and she's commanding a certain kind of attention. And that's totally appropriate, right? But as we grow, we can continue to be what a psychoanalyst called emperor baby, right? I am the center of the universe. I want this. I want you to get out of my way. Or like a friend of mine used to say, when things didn't go the way he wanted, he'd say, but I don't want mustard on my hot dog. You know, it's like that. So we look at these habits of body, speech, and mind that keep us perpetuating this very rigid, grasping, self-centered existence, and we loosen that up and say, well, what is it like for me to step out of the center of the universe, be aware of my needs, and have what Dogen Zenji called the dignified activity of a Buddha. The dignified activity of a Buddha is a creative presence in the world. Right? This is show. A creative presence in the world. A contribution, but not like organizing everything to my preferences. And this happens in a moment. It happens in a moment. We can't cling to something. So one moment, you may be like living realization. And the next moment, you may be totally cranky and grasping, and then you're grasping Buddha. Right? So it's only for this moment. Practice realization happens in this moment. This is a second translation of this. The view that practice and enlightenment are not one is heretical. In the Buddha Dharma, they are one. Inasmuch as practice is based on enlightenment, the practice of a beginner, this is important, is entirely that of enlightenment. Therefore, in giving the instructions for practice, a Zen teacher advises his or her disciples not to seek enlightenment beyond practice. For practice itself is enlightenment. Because it is already enlightenment of practice, there is no end to enlightenment. Because it is already practice of enlightenment, there is no beginning to practice. So there's this endlessness in this presence and this one moment after another. Okay? That's practice realization. So in a sense, it's quite simple. This moment of practice is a complete manifestation of enlightenment. Do you believe that? Somebody's nodding her head, yes. Do you believe that the practice of a beginner is identical to somebody who's been sitting for 40, 50, 60 years? Do you believe that? Mm-hmm. It is identical. In Soto Zen, we don't have higher practices. We all do the same thing until we die. So this is, and one moment of practice is one moment of enlightenment, and you can't cling to it. Because then it's the next moment, the next moment, the next moment, the next moment. So you just wake up. To be gone? Yes, Master. Are you awake? Yes, Master. Or not. Don't be fooled. You will be fooled. And then maybe the next moment you won't be fooled. The implications of this are profound. There's a kind of responsibility or a kind of not in a really oppressive way, but there is a sense of being called to be awake in your life. You can't pretend that it's somebody else's job. Like, oh, that person that's like this special person that is in a monastery or something. It's not like that. You can't escape. Your ordinary life is a Buddha field. The one you've got. The body you've got, the mind you've got, the heart you've got, the psyche you've got, everything you've got, you're fine. There's nothing else you need. And any story that you have that you need something else, or you need to go someplace else, or you need to put on special clothes, or anything, is just a story. Yeah.
I remember I talked with somebody about the idea And the word that came to mind in some degree is daunting, in that
daunting.
I think the expression was, it's all the time?
Yeah. It's all the time, and one of my teachers said, you know, after about, I don't know, 30 years of practice, many, many of them at Tassajara, she's done probably more practice periods at Tassajara than anybody on earth. She said, I realize this is it. Just this is it. Excuse me. Because we hear that, we hear this is it, we go, whoa, this is it? Cool. But actually, it really, just this is it. Just this life, the one you got, just this body. Yeah.
So does that, to me, that reflects a problem more in our society, that we're being driven and promoted, encouraged to aspire to other things, mm-hmm. and to change and mm-hmm. grow, mm-hmm. all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Bye. And bye.
Yes.
Bye.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do all this stuff
yeah.
that ultimately, it's still just ordinary life.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a couple of things going on there. One is the idea of grasping, and that somehow, somewhere, we're going to get it right and everything's going to be okay, is fundamentally human form of delusion.
Regardless of our current society's pace?
That fundamental human delusion has got hijacked by capitalism, right? And we get fed all this stuff. It gets hijacked by any system that we're in, right? There, you know, multiple forms of suffering. Our particular brand is the Horatio Alger myth, right? You need to be famous and special, or you don't count. That's like all these idols and special, you know, all that stuff. And also you need to buy a lot of stuff. And if you buy the right thing, somehow you'll be happy. But it's the same thing of grasping and possessing, and that if somehow I can make this work, but I cannot. You know, the deluded I will just fill it with one thing after another. We know this. And the thing that's tricky, of course, that's interesting, is if you get just the right thing, it does make you happy for a little while, right?
Just a little while.
So we have to have a sense of humor about this. We can't get grim about, if you get grim about practice, you're sunk. You have to have a sense of humor, a sense of warmth, a sense of appreciation of this deluded human being who's just doing their best. But that doesn't mean you get to run amok. You know, there's this tension there. Yeah.
I think it's really liberating to when you realize that there isn't anything to grasp at or go for,
uh-huh.
but just this is it, is really liberating.
Yeah, it is. You know, years ago, I quit my job, and I fixed up the back of my truck, and I just decided I was going to go visit Dharma centers and friends and stuff. And so I had this very little space in the back of my truck that I lived in, and I was using my money to travel. And so I didn't have any money to buy anything. And I would go to these wonderful places. I remember I was up in Maine, and I saw this beautiful stuff, and I would think, oh, this is like being in a museum. I'm not going to buy this, because number one, I don't have the money. Number two, I don't have the space. It was a very interesting experience. I was in my 20s, you know, I'd never really, and I'd encountered the Dharma before, but there was something about actually living that out for a while, saying, no, you don't need it. And I would find things, I'd think, oh, Patrick would just love that. Well, I'll send him a picture. Yeah.
Something along the same vein, a little bit different. As you know, I work with people who are blind or visually impaired adults. And in the support group, one of my clients, she had lost her vision from being shot in the face,
mm-hmm.
By a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just railing and saying, you know, I changed my whole life to come to Santa Cruz where it's safe.
Uh-huh.
And this is what's happened, and I have to leave now, but I don't know where to go, where it's safe.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, everybody was saying, you know, there is no guaranteed safety anywhere. But
I mean, that's a terrible reality to face, you know, because we do want, there are safer places and not safer places in this world. You know, that's the truth of it. And safety is a huge motivating factor for us as human beings, and rightfully so. And ultimately, bad things happen. And it's a terrible thing when it happens. Terrible. So, we need to both say, ultimately, safety is an illusion in a certain way. But at the same time, our heart breaks. We want to create safety and caring and beauty for people and for other beings. So we live in this wisdom and compassion world, back and forth, back and forth. No self, self. No self, self. No safety, heartbreak, and desire for safety, appropriately so. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. This is our practice, you know, to live in that reality. So one more point I want to make before we go into more questions is... This is by a wonderful Buddhist scholar named Francis Cook. If you have a chance to read his works. The term Dogen uses very often, and which he seems to prefer, is not Satori or Kensho, which has a sense of cracking through, breaking open, having a special awakening experience, but rather sho, and its verbal form, sho shiru, meaning proof, evidence, to prove, to guarantee. Fundamental to just about everything we mean when we speak of Dogen Zen is his central teaching that everything, including ourselves, is already Buddha, right from the beginning. And consequently, what we call awakening or enlightenment can only be a process of proving to ourselves this fact. And we do that over and over and over again. This is called authentication. So this is real, making real. Realization is making real, right? We make real our awakening. We make real our practice every moment. And there's no escape. What this means is that liberation, awakening, liberation is not liberation from duality or the circumstances of the world. We're not getting out of anything. We're being liberated to the circumstances of the world. We're being liberated to duality, to this paradox that we live with, to this ordinary life, to places where people have terrible experiences like that. We're being liberated into the world, not from it. So, this is another scholar says, the crucially important thing to note is that in Dogen, opposites or dualities are not obliterated or even blurred. They are not so much transcended as realized. The absolute freedom in question here is that freedom which realizes itself in duality, not apart from it. In Dogen's view, the dualistic world remains real, not dissolved. Therefore, the unity in question of practice and realization does not replace distinction, but is unobstructed by it. Okay? So we'll come back to that again next week. But I want you to think about this in your daily life. Think about this. What is it like to be liberated to this world, not from this world? What is it like to actually embrace the duality, the particularity of this experience, this person, this life, comfortable or uncomfortable, whatever it is, to be engaged with it, to be liberated into it, so that your realization is what's really happening, not a not theory about it or a remove from it. So to keep this word show and this sense of name and nature and being in particularity kind of alive for yourself, and then we can talk about it again next week. Okay, questions, comments? Covered a lot of material. Yeah.
So the practice of a beginner.
The what?
Not the practice of a beginner.
Uh-huh.
Not being different than somebody practicing for 40 years.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't you say that the maybe the occurrences are more frequent for somebody who's more experienced?
Possibly. Possibly. I don't mean to say that we don't progress in practice. We do. I think we give more freely to ourselves and others over time. However, in that moment of practice, it doesn't matter who the one is that practices. That moment of being liberated to the world, of being, it doesn't matter who the vehicle of that is. That moment of realization is the very same moment for whoever is the person we associate with it. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, you know, that's what we mean by it's the same. Yeah.
To serve others.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting, when I saw you move your hand up and down like this, it was delimiting between the duality. But to serve others is the moment of acts of kindness.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah.
So, and it you'll always flip, I say that you'll always flip back into the other duality. Mm-hmm. But then there is the moment coming back to serve others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
This is, you know, we'll be talking about in the next week or the following week about the Bodhisattva vow. And the Bodhisattva vow is to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. That's the fundamental orientation. And so, as you point out, service to others is essential. It's the path. And that, and again, it takes very ordinary ways, and it's going to be unique for each of us in a certain way. There's, you know, this is part of one of the reasons I love the teaching so much, is that we're not need to be homogenous. Service for one person can be really different, take a very different form than service to the world of another. Right? We have our own gifts and talents that we give to the world, and we serve in that way. So, you're a musician, or you're a nurse, or you're, you know, stay-at-home mom or dad, or you're a scientist, or you're whatever, all of these forms that you do can be service to the world. It doesn't necessarily have to be running a soup kitchen. You know, there's something about the spirit of that, though, that's very real. Yeah. Yes.
So saying that it's all Buddha nature to me is really saying that it's all good and it's all perfect. Everything. So, you know, somebody shooting somebody, it's Buddha nature. And And karma, you know, in my view, is opportunities to wake up. Everything mm-hmm. that happens, opportunity to wake up. Getting shot in the face, opportunity to wake up. And our lives, they're so very different. And some people just seem to, you know, get all the bad luck. And uh-huh. and other people, they're just like, whoa, gliding through.
And looks like it.
And what's that?
I said it can look like it.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, in terms of...
Absolutely, I agree.
You know, poverty and violence.
You bet. We are not in Syria right now.
Yeah, right. So, Buddha nature, I mean, it's all good. It doesn't all feel good. But if you widen, if you're able to step out of your story, the names... I remember when I first started hearing the word terrorist, and I thought, what the hell is a terrorist? You know? I mean, a guy in a plane is a guy in a plane with a set of beliefs who believes something, and he just happened to, you know, drive into a building, but now he has another name, mm-hmm. and I never, it's like, really? I mean, what the hell's a terrorist? So anyway, I'm diverging, but I really think that... at least for me, the last few years have been about seeing, watching my immediate reaction, like, oh, and then letting that go
yeah.
and widening the story. So it's not all bad.
It is. I mean, this is where we live in these two worlds, right? Uh-huh. On the one hand, everything is an opportunity to wake up. On mm-hmm. the other hand, terrible things happen and we need to do everything we can mm-hmm. to alleviate suffering. Mm-hmm. So we live in both worlds. Mm-hmm. And it's like the teachings where there are these different realms. Mm-hmm. There's the heavenly realm, and there's the realm of the warring gods, and then there's the human realm, and then there's the animal realm, and then there's the hell realms, right? And the teaching is that living in the human realm is the best place to wake up, because we basically have enough suffering that we want to get off our butts and do something, but it's not so much suffering that we're overwhelmed and crushed by it. And we can look at our world in the same way, that we want to create for all beings this place mm-hmm. where there's not so much crushing suffering. That now, amazing human beings like Nelson Mandela can maintain awakening and the Bodhisattva vow and all that after 27 years in prison, being called by a number. Most of us are more flawed than that. So we need to both work to alleviate suffering and create the best opportunities for people to live wholesome lives, and also understand the actual consequences of racism and violence and all the delusions that we perpetuate, and that human beings collapse under that, the weight of those of that oppression. Mm-hmm. We cannot, most of us are crushed mm-hmm. at past a certain point mm-hmm. with karmic circumstances. So we need to do everything we can to heal this world. And at the same time, everything is a possibility of waking up. Again, it's both. Our responsibility is in both ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
I have an anecdote and a question. We get lots of marketing telemarketers on mm-hmm. our phone. And usually we just let it go, but I was standing by the phone and I noticed, like, for the umpteenth time, this readout, you know, was telling me it was the same telemarketer had called. And I picked up the phone and said, "Who are you?" And before they could answer, I said, "Why are you calling me?" And then I went on for a while, "Don't call me ever again. I don't want to get any phone calls here. Leave me alone." Wow, and I felt so good.
Oh.
God, so righteous.
Powerful.
And Sita said, you know, she might have been a working mom.
Yep.
Through a minimum wage.
That's right.
And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. And my question is, I can't call her up and apologize.
Uh-huh.
So how do I Where do I think I know what I got out of that is I think I got the lesson. Yeah, I got okay.
Yeah.
I love to be righteous, you know, but there's a case where
he doesn't.
I think I'm gonna have to let go of that one.
Yeah. Well, this
but how do I, aside from trying to get the lesson, she said, well, maybe you could have a fantasy where you apologize to her, which is, yeah, that's great, but I don't, anyway, that's sort of my dilemma.
I think every telemarketer that ever contacts you for the rest of your life becomes that woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you treat every telemarketer with the kind of clarity and respect that you would have wished you would have given her.
Or just don't answer the phone.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean you have to be nice or, you know, I mean, not like, oh yeah, please tell me everything. It just means being respectful and clear. And this, again, is working with aggressive anger, aggressive energy. If we clarify it, we can be very straightforward and clear without being angry or righteous. You know, we're just clear. No. I'm busy right now. Have a good day.
Well, what's really clear is how I so enjoy that feeling of righteousness.
Yeah. This is the deluded self just having a field day. It's like, I won the field. I'm going to take advantage of it and play it out to the hilt. Right?
Very seductive.
Yeah, it is.
But that's interesting, though. Now, I would think you're not going to enjoy it as much anymore because you see there's consequences to it.
Maybe not.
I think what I would enjoy would have having the equanimity to deal with somebody from a centered place is a deeper kind of enjoyment.
And this is interesting because it's really important that we, in our practice, taste the pleasure of practice. We have to taste the pleasure. Pleasure is really, really important. So if it just becomes this grim, brutal thing where I got to be good, no.
Every time I have to stop and get out my wallet and give out a quarter because he asked me.
So we taste just what you're talking about. Yes, there's a certain pleasure that comes out of righteousness, but actually when we pay attention, the pleasure of equanimity and giving respect to another human being is way more pleasant. It's nicer for us, and it's nicer for the other person. And there's something about tasting the pleasure of having equanimity and having kindness and being alive to the world in that way that's way better. But we have to learn that. A couple more questions and then we'll end.
I was just thinking it also brings you back to the present moment, because when I get angry like that, I stay angry. Right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Whereas if I have some equanimity, it's done. I move on to the next moment.
Good point. Good point.
Well, I was thinking when you're examining those things, it's important to examine what you get out of it. I think about, you know, don't be fooled.
Yeah.
When you have that righteous anger, yourself gets to reinforce its selfness.
Yeah, you bet.
You know, I am mad at you over there.
Yeah.
And even if you flip it around, well, now I feel guilty. And so you can even reinforce your selfness.
Good point.
Flipping it.
Yeah,
so
good point.
So I think
point.
It's really important to examine what's going on inside, because it's so easy to be fooled.
Yeah, good point, good point. And we get fooled over and over and over again. We'll be fooled till we'll die. We always get fooled. That's okay. It's what we do with it. Right? So pay attention to show. Pay attention to, you know, this place. And we'll talk some more about it next week.